I'm going to law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is a 6'9 swingman. He can shoot the three.
Oh, this is so contrived.
I mean, this is America, isn't it?
Hello, and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the episode for Monday, March 2nd, 2009. I'm Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer for Alligator Sports, and with me today are...
Evan Drexler, sports editor and football beat writer.
Kyle Maestri, baseball beat writer.
Mike McCall, football beat writer.
Mike DiFernando, basketball beat writer.
All right, we're coming to you on the tail end of an abysmal weekend in Florida sports. I think every team that played this weekend, with the exception of softball, lost, and softball suffered a loss of its own, which we'll get to a little bit later. We're also going to touch on the baseball team's weekend sweep against Miami. But we're going to start off, we're going to talk a little bit about the men's basketball team. Defer, talk to us about what happened this week.
Florida loses 79-75 to Tennessee today, Sunday. Bad loss for them. Pretty much in a corner now. They've got to probably win the last two games of the season. It's Mississippi State and Kentucky if they want to make the tournament. They just don't match up well with Tennessee. I mean, this is the seventh. They've lost seven of the last eight, five in a row to Tennessee. The problem for Florida is they just don't have the athletes to match up with Tennessee. And it was really evident today. They got manhandled pretty much position for position, so... It was a bad loss.
So are we saying that's all that went wrong? I mean, what? Let's get a little more detail here. What went wrong in that loss?
I mean, I didn't watch the game, but I didn't have to tell you what happened. Tennessee's more athletic. They're taller. They're faster. Neither team is good. But when one team is taller and faster, unless Florida has like an outrageous shooting night or something, I don't see them beating Tennessee. I just don't see it happening.
It's not just taller and faster. I mean, this thing's problematic going back to the Georgia loss and going back to other losses. I think they don't play defense at all. They just don't bother. Like, the first half, I was watching it on a game tracker during the baseball game, and I just saw Tennessee was 7-9 at the end of the first half from three. They were shooting 65% from the field. They had more points in the paint. It was the same stuff that we've seen in other games. I think one problem is they don't play defense. The second problem, and I think Defer can speak to this, whether or not this is true, I think they react really poorly to big moments in the game. I think when something goes right for the other team and the crowd goes nuts, or if you're at home and the crowd goes silent, and you can feel the momentum shift, I think the 0-4s were always very unflappable. Something like that would happen. They'd come back down, do what they needed to do. They'd get the next stop. They'd get the next basket. I think this team tends to rush and let their emotions get the best of them in situations like that, and they'll frequently miss a shot when they have to or they don't. They have a defensive lapse, and I think a lot of times opposing crowds can take them out of the game, or just big moments takes them out of the game.
Yeah, you really have a sense that when the momentum starts to swing in the other team's favor, they just kind of say, oh, here it goes again, we're going to lose. They kind of pack it in a little bit. The main problem was pretty much defense. They refused to not play zone defense, and that was killing them because Tennessee was shooting the ball like crazy. And they were busting the zone. They had to go to man, and they just wouldn't do it. So that really cost them.
Yeah, the fans sitting behind us in press row, a lot of times they'll scream, hey, guys, they're going to play zone again. Yeah, they're going to play zone.
No layups.
Yeah, no layups, and they're going to play zone again because, you know, the offenses always know the Gators are going to play zone. But they're leaving shooters wide open. When Wayne Chisholm's hitting three-pointers completely uncontested, Tyler Smith is hitting three-pointers completely uncontested, and a three-pointer goes in to end the first half when the Gators might have been making a little run there. It just completely kills any momentum, and it happened also, you know, at the second half. They're coming close. They might have a chance to win this game. They're down by 3 points. A couple three-pointers here, a couple late fouls, and game's over for the Gators.
I mean, you guys mentioned them playing zone too much. Do they really need to be in man? Are they really going to match up? I mean,
when things are going like that, you just don't have a choice. Like, I know they're not a great man team, and there's a lot of individual weaknesses. But you know what they should do? They should play like I told our intramural team to play, and that is the other team's better than you. So we're going to try to slow the game down. We're going to try to slow the game down, keep the scoring down, and we're going to try to win games 62-59. I know they like to run. I know they like to push the ball. But it means sitting Urban Walker on the bench, who's great offensively, and putting in Ray Shipman, who's much better defensively, and playing some friggin' man defense, and not pushing the ball and taking a shot early in the shot clock, Billy should make an adjustment, because they're losing the same way every time, and it's not because of the offense, it's because they don't play any friggin' defense.
I'd like to point out that our intramural team went 0-3-1-1, or we didn't win any games.
We were mercy ruled
three times, it didn't work out. Because... they were better than us. They were more athletic. We didn't match up man-to-man, and we didn't shoot well. And that's pretty much what Florida does.
So you're comparing our intramural team to the Florida basketball
team? I think
we'd
match up pretty well.
Well, and Kyle does make a good point about Irving Walker. As much as I love Irving Walker, he can't match up on defense against most bigger guards. And that's where Ray Shipman really would do well. And he had a good game today, especially offensively. He had a good three-point shot and a great drive to the basket late in the game. So I think Ray Shipman's someone that needs to probably play a little bit more.
This is something I didn't see because I didn't watch a whole lot of the game. I was streaming it in the press box in softball. How did he do on defense? Because that's sort of what we promoted him as being, is the defensive stopper. How did he,
Ray's an athletic kid. When he gets out there, he does play well on defense. But one player can't stop an entire team. You can't have Ray Shipman take out, like, five guys.
Here's a problem, too, is that other teams get switches off screen so easily. Like, you saw it against Jody Meeks in the final play of the Kentucky game, where Ray's picking him up full court. They get one screen, and suddenly Nick Calathes is on him because they don't fight through screens, and they just don't do the effort things on defense that are going to help them out. If a team can just take the defender they want off of, you know, off of their best player at any time, like, okay, you got Ray Shipman on me now, but we're going to screen away from him, and all of a sudden you got Irvin Walker on you. Like, things like that can't happen. They have to play better than that. They have to show high on screens, trap the guy, and then get back. Like, they just don't do things that the good defensive teams do, and that's the problem.
I think it all goes back to the point McCall's trying to make, is that no matter how much you're changing up your strategy, they're just not talented enough to, beat these teams that they're playing against. It's not a matter of defense. It might save a couple points here and there, but if they're just physically outmanned by every other team they're playing, it's not going to make a difference.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was in the part of the game that I did see, I saw Dan Warner in the post trying to guard Tennessee's biggest guy, and it's a foregone conclusion at that point. Tennessee is going to score because Dan Warner is on the low block just getting destroyed.
He gave it everything he had, though.
But it...
He always does.
It's not. I think you guys, you haven't seen them try to do the things I want them to do to win games. And I think that's the problem. Like, so many times you get on here and you talk about if you have shoots real well, they'll beat people, and if they don't, they won't. But you watch a game like the Georgia loss where they shot the ball really well and they played as good as you can play offensively, and it didn't matter. They lost to the worst team in the SEC, shooting the ball amazing. It's all about defense. That's how you win games. That's why the 04s won games, because they played great defense. That's why any team wins championships and is good. So I think Billy needs to put that first and make sure that he puts that first. We're not going to work on pushing the ball and reversing and scoring and shooting threes and getting open looks, penetration, kick out. None of that matters. Just play defense and slow the game down one time and just see how it goes, because I don't know how the team would look like that, and nobody in this room knows how the team would look playing like that.
At this point in the season, I have to assume that at some point, Billy Donovan has made defense a priority in practice.
Yeah.
And it's not working. That's, to be a great defensive team, you have to work at that. At this point, they're not going to be able to fix this in time to make the tournament and have a run in the tournament. The only thing that they can – the thing that's a variable is how they shoot. They're not going to play great defense. They're just not. Maybe it's they don't have the scheme. Maybe it's they don't have the athleticism. But it's not working, and I don't see it clicking all of a sudden when they've been so bad.
It's the style of play, though. It's not that they're like they're slowing the game down and they're making sure they get their defense set up and they're not giving up transition baskets and they're not playing at 100 miles an hour. Just their pace of play dictates that the game's going to be high scoring and that both teams are going to get a lot of possessions. If they just I would just like to see them switch their pace of play. Nothing else is going to work. This is an NIT team. This was a terrible loss for them. They lose all the time. Why not just switch for one game, try to slow the game down and play some defense? I think that is just give the other team a different look.
At the crucial point they're in here where they've got two games left and they've got to win them both to get in the tournament, I don't really like a change in philosophy at this point. It's risky, sure, it would have a high payoff if it works, but like there's not really a reason to think that it would necessarily. Now, if it's midseason, I'm all for you kicking down his door and getting in his face about it, but I think right now it's kind of too late. Just got to go with what you have.
As the team is right now, can it get in there? I mean, can they win these last two games?
Yeah, going into the last four games when they were, 6-4 or whatever they were, we said, okay, they've got four games left. They need to win two. They need to get to – no, I'm sorry, they were 8-4. They've got to win two of the last four games to have 10 wins in the conference and then not lose in the first round of the SEC tournament. They'll make it. Looking at those four games, LSU, going to be a loss. Tennessee, going to be a loss. Mississippi State, not sure. Kentucky, they better win. They better beat Kentucky. They should have beaten Kentucky last time, and they should beat them this time. So, yeah, they lost two games, and it seems like they're in a hole, but I think they lost the games they're supposed to lose, and now they need to win the games they're supposed to win.
Kyle, you didn't think they'd lose the Tennessee game, right?
Yeah, I thought for sure they'd beat Tennessee. So it's worse than I thought for them. Like, it's really bad. Tennessee, to me, is not a good team. They have 10 losses. They've lost to Auburn on the road. They've lost to Kentucky. They've lost to teams that aren't great teams, and for them to come in here and just blow them away in the first half, get out to a huge start, And the Gators really just looked like, you know, they had nothing to play for. When they had everything to play for, it was just terrible. And these games hurt twice as bad because not only is UF in danger, okay, we might not get to 10 wins, but these other teams, these last four teams that they're playing, they're all competing for tournament spots. The Kentuckys and the Mississippi States and Tennessee, they're all on that bubble too, trying to get in. So when they lose, they're taking wins away from themselves and they're giving it to people who are going to get in those tournament spots in front of them.
So Florida's lost 7 of the last 8 to Tennessee. Do we believe that maybe Tennessee just has their number, or like?
I mean, the 3-point shooting sure seems to seem that way. I mean, Tennessee shoots second worst in the entire conference coming into today.
29% against the rest of the conference and 47% against Florida.
So, I mean, there's got to be something. Those are numbers that don't just, you know, deviate. That's a huge difference.
Isn't Florida playing to kind of give them those shots, or aren't they buckling down? And so I know that's what they did last time. I didn't watch this game, but is that what they did? Were they concentrating more on the inside?
I mean, they're running the zone. They're trying to take – they know that's their weak spot. So they're consciously trying to take away the inside. So that is part of it. But, I mean, still.
Because, I mean, if Tennessee – we'd have to go back and watch all these other games where they're shooting so poorly. I'm sure they're missing some open shots, but they're probably getting contested on some of them too. And even if you're contesting it with Florida and you throw Irving Walker and Hodge out there, were they going to punch him in the waist or something? I mean –
He's up on the Irv gym.
With the Tennessee – I love Irv. Does Tennessee have their number thing? I'll concede that when they're in Knoxville, it's like, okay, maybe that's a hard place to play, and they go in there and the fans are into it and it's a different environment. I find that really hard to say blanketly when you're playing in Gainesville, though. Like, no team should just blanketly have your number when players are going in and out. This isn't Chris Lofton and Juwan Smith. This is, you know, these are young players that they should have a chance against, and they shouldn't buckle just because it says Tennessee across their jersey and Bruce Pearl's on the sideline.
And UF hadn't lost up to this point this season at home, right? So, I mean, it's got to be something Tennessee's doing, right?
It's that wild crowd support in the O'Connell Center. I guess
it was a full crowd today, so give the Florida fans a little credit. It was a good crowd.
We could hear it from the empty baseball stadium.
that's true.
Also, students who roam around to seats to steal the free T-shirts, you should be ashamed of yourselves. there's a T-shirt on every chair for each person attending the game, and if you're walking around, I saw kids wearing 3 layers of those free T-shirts, orange, blue. That's just embarrassing, and you should be ashamed of yourselves.
Did you or someone close to you get cheated out of a T-shirt today?
No. That did not happen, but I think it's a shameful act that you should go around stealing
T-shirts.
There'll
be a Goodwill next week.
Or on eBay. So we're saying that UF basketball fans are terrible, I'm pointing at McCall here, and shameful by Evan.
That is accurate, yes.
It's a really good season for them. All right, now we're going to move on to a little bit of talk about the UF baseball team. Kyle, they were swept by Miami this weekend with a terrible loss today. Talk us through the weekend, what happened here.
Yeah, Friday night, Keating matched up with Chris Hernandez, who's Miami's stud pitcher. And the UF lineup got to him a little bit. They actually took the lead twice, and Keating promptly surrendered it due to Jonathan Weislow, who played left field for Miami and hit 9th all weekend. And he had never hit a home run going into this series, and he hit 2 against Keating Friday night. So they lost that game 8-5. They were in it. They could have won. Next game, they lost 2-1. Pantoliotis gave up 8 hits in his start, pitched 5 2/3. But scattered the hits. He didn't give up any big hits. Got outs when he needed to. They had a chance to come back and win in the 9th, but they couldn't get it done against Miami's closer. They lost that game 2-1. You would think they'd come out Sunday, try to at least take one game. That was not the plan, however. Nick Morande really pitched poorly, which I thought he'd be good this season, so I'm not going to condemn him after one start. But he missed his spots a lot, got in trouble in the 4th. Miami busted open the scoring in the 7-run 4th inning, never looked back. Ended up winning 16-2. They put 20 hits on the scoreboard. UF had more errors, 3-2. They only had 4 hits. It was just a terrible game. Anything that could have went wrong today went wrong for them.
All right, and you said they changed up the lineup a lot. A lot of crazy things going on there.
O'Sullivan shuffled the lineup quite a bit. Mike Mooney moved into the 2-hole for Saturday's game and stayed there for Sunday as well, up from, you know, where he'd been hitting 9th in the order for most of the rest of the season. He's kind of moved Dendecker. He's hit 2nd, 3rd, 4th. Same Josh Adams has moved up and down in that lineup. Jericho Weitzel got a couple starts Saturday and Sunday at 2nd base. Clayton Pisani wasn't playing. You saw different pinch hitters come in when they were getting blown out. Daniel Piggott got a start today. Ben McMahon got a couple at-bats. So, saw a lot of different faces. O'Sullivan didn't seem too happy with any of it. He just thought they did a terrible job at the plate this weekend, which they definitely did. So, expect him to keep shuffling the lineup.
I don't know if it was in you or Bobby's live blog this weekend, but somebody brought up the point that they'd get the runners in scoring position and just absolutely couldn't capitalize. Do you feel like him changing around the lineup maybe affected that a little bit, or what?
Yeah, that was especially true in Saturday's 2-1 loss. They had all kinds of runners on base, and they just couldn't drive them in. They left 11 on for the game and had multiple scoring opportunities early and just didn't scratch them across. I think what that is that they haven't hit for power as a team at all. So when you're not hitting extra base hits, it's hard to drive guys in. They pretty much have to be, you know, on third base, and you hit a single, or they have to be on second base, driven in with a single. And they just had a really rough go of it. I think another problem is once you just get past about the fourth hitter, MacArthur, or whoever is hitting there for that day, there's really not a lot to work with in the lower half of the line, lower third of the lineup, and that's something that they're going to have to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of the year when we talked about this team, the two things that they're going to have to find is a big power threat, somebody in the lineup who's going to have a big bat that's going to be feared, and then the freshman pitchers are going to have to come up huge because they're using so many of them. And yeah, this sweep isn't good. You never want to get swept by your rival, especially coming off sweeping then number 8 Louisville to start the season. You know, everybody's thinking good things for this team. This is definitely a step in the wrong direction, obviously, and no one's happy about it, but to me, the more troubling things is what you saw in those two areas. There's no one who's really a feared hitter at the plate. I mean, you got Dendecker, Adams, MacArthur, and this freshman phenom, Preston Tucker, that Bobby and Kyle love so much, that, you know, they're up and down. They don't really do anything consistently. Riley Cooper from the football team has had a pretty good start of the season. But also, I mean, you look at the pitchers. I mean, Pantaleotis did pretty well on Saturday, I thought. I mean, only gave up 2 runs in 5.2 innings. That's not bad. But then today was pretty disappointing. Nick Morande, the ace of the freshman, he was the big recruit coming in, the gem of the class, goes 3.2 innings, gives up 6 hits, 7 runs, 4 of them earned. He walked 4 people, struck out 2 in 75 pitches, and he also pegged 2 batters. So
I think you could pinpoint, you'll probably agree with me today, when things just really, you knew it was done. And they had a chance to get out of that fourth inning having given up 4 runs. Morande was still on the hill, or 2 outs. And Miami pops a ball up. I think it was Ryan Jackson, the shortstop, to first base. It hangs in the air forever. MacArthur is kind of tracking it. The wind's moving it around a little bit. He eventually runs into Jericho Weitzel. Ball pops out of his glove, and they score a couple more runs that inning. And you just got the feeling where it was like, wow, everybody was really down after that moment. It was like this easy fly ball would have ended the already bad inning for them. And from then, it was just like they were just completely mentally done for the game.
That was another thing that I thought should be added to the list of disappointments for McCall's list was the infield play. They had a bunch of errors, 3, I believe, on Friday night, and one of them by third baseman Josh Adams that kept an inning going that allowed 3 of those runs to come in. And so only 3 of Keating's 6 runs allowed that night were earned. And, you know, if that doesn't happen, then the Gators are still leading the game. And just, you know, after that, it kind of snowballed. They had a great eighth inning rally going on Friday night. They had the bases loaded and then a ground ball, close play at first. It was a questionable call whether the batter was safe or not. And that kind of, you know, might have disheartened the team for the rest of the weekend, that rally falling short with a questionable call.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the infield play. Mike Mooney, the shortstop, is supposed to be this, like, defensive wizard. And he's got 3 errors already. And it's been pretty disappointing. I mean, even some of the plays they've made have been kind of shaky. I guess it's early season. They still got some things to work out, but that's one of those things you kind of expect to go well.
Yeah, I think the outfield play has been really solid. Riley Cooper robbed a home run in the Louisville series. Avery Barnes made a great sliding catch the other day in foul territory, and they've been holding, you know, potential doubles to singles, stuff
great
like cutoffs. That. But the infield, yeah, it's just been terrible. I think they've made so many errors on the infield, and you just can't win games like that. I'm starting to think that's the only reason they beat Louisville, is because Louisville shot themselves in the foot so many times, and they made so many errors and walked so many hitters that, you know, you can't win baseball games like that, which is kind of how UF played against Miami, by contrast.
Let's talk about something you mentioned before. Riley Cooper, he's had a pretty decent start to his season at the plate so far, right?
Yeah, I mean, McCall and I had a conversation preseason about how Riley Cooper should just give up baseball and play football, but we were wrong, I guess, because he's been one of the best players for them. He's done very well. He's hit safely in every game except for one this season, and has hit for some power, too. He has a few doubles, a home run, a grand slam, actually. And he's really looked great, actually. So, I mean, nothing but good things about Riley Cooper so far this season.
Today was the first blemish, though, where I think you saw maybe some of his football field mentality carrying over onto the baseball field. In the sixth inning, which was the first inning today that Florida got any runners past second base, they scored two runs in the inning. And then at the end of the inning, Cooper's on first. There's a ground ball to shortstop. They flip it to second. They're about to turn two. And in the inning, Cooper slides past the bag and kind of takes out Scott Lawson, Miami's second baseman. And then Cooper gets up, and I guess Lawson kind of bumped him, but it looked incidental. And then Cooper shoved him, like a full-out shove. He gets tossed from the game, which actually he got tossed on the slide. And then Jonathan Weaselow, the hero from the first game, the number nine hitter, comes jogging in from left field and shoves Cooper back. Florida's bench, like, clears. They come out onto the field. Nothing happened. Miami's players stay in the dugout. But I think right there you saw, like, Evan talked about all the missed opportunities in the first two games, and that was kind of all their frustrations just boiling over.
Well, yeah, I think the frustration definitely showed up there. But I like, you know, Riley Cooper, they're down 1,000 runs. They have no chance of winning the game. He's still running hard into second base. He's trying to break up the double play. I didn't think it was a particularly dirty slide. I think there was a rule in college baseball, though, Jim Morris, the Miami coach, was saying, if you slide over the base, they're going to call interference and they're going to throw you out, which is what he did. But I don't think he went in with the intention to hurt. He was right around the base. Second baseman was straddling, so it wasn't like he went out of his way to take the guy out. I think he was just making a hard baseball play, and then he took exception to the fact that Lawson bumped him, and things kind of went from there. But they need that kind of attitude. You know, it's not okay to get the crap beat out of you. Like, when that happens, you should stand up and try to fight back a little bit, and I think that's good for them.
The biggest difference between this year and last year for Riley Cooper is timing. Last year, he came in halfway through the season. His swing was way off. He was striking out constantly. This year, he really got it going early. He was doing all the training with the team. And just his extra time that he's had to focus on baseball instead of football is really showing right now. Got, I think, a 360 batting average. So you just really tell, because last year he came in and the players didn't know him. This year, he got to, you know, mesh with the team a little bit more. The coach knows him better. He shaved his hair. Coach O'Sullivan wasn't having any of that long hair stuff. And I don't know, he just seems like he's more involved in the team when you talk to him and when you see him at the plate.
Well, Kyle was talking about the need to stand up for yourselves and retaliate when you're down by that much. And I think the most disappointing thing we saw all weekend, I think I could say this for a fact, after Weaselow pushes Cooper, he comes up to bat the next inning, and Chaz Spotswood, the pitcher for Florida, he throws a slow curve, like 55 miles an hour, into Weaselow's back and puts him on. And then that led to the discussion, first of all, if you're going to peg somebody, peg them. You don't throw a slow curve in the back. We couldn't figure out, like, was his command of his slow curve better than his fastball today?
I just pictured us interviewing after the game, like, yo, did you hit him on purpose, Chaz? And he's like, well, you know, I just wanted to send a message that if you mess with the Gators, you might take a changeup off the Nike swoosh. Like, what kind of message is that?
That was really disappointing. And then I started thinking about how ridiculous the whole tradition of pegging someone is. Like, I understand you want to hurt somebody, you want to send a message, but you're putting someone on base.
Yeah.
So here's my thinking. You throw the first pitch either over his head or behind him, or brush him back, whatever, and then you better strike him out. You strike the guy out on three pitches. Better yet, you have your position players in the field lay down on the ground while you strike him out because he's not putting the ball in play. You want to embarrass someone? You want to get back at someone? Do that and get an out. Don't put them on base with a soft toss to the back.
Well, let me just say, the unwritten rules of baseball is part of what makes the game great. And Weaselow should have taken one, should have taken the 90-mile-an-hour fastball off the wrist for what he did. I mean, he ran in there and pushed Riley Cooper after the play for no reason whatsoever. It was a shock to me that he wasn't ejected. So I wouldn't have been surprised if they threw at him. But yeah, to throw him with a curveball is absolutely ridiculous. Hit him with a fastball. And as far as the lay down on the field to strike him out, I mean, obviously, you're going to put yourself in a position where you're going to give up a run like that. So there's a reason why they just put one in your back and let you take first base. But that's just the way the code goes. If you do something stupid, that's how you protect your players. Is when you come up to the plate, you're going to get thrown at. That's just the way things work.
McCall just wants to rewrite the code of baseball.
Yeah, you want to send a message, strike him out, and show him you're not afraid of him at all. Bring the infield all the way in. Have everyone sit around the pitcher's mound and watch.
Look, it's hard to strike guys out. It's not hard to hit them in the back with a fastball. Right? And that's really what this boils down to.
I have a quick basketball story that
I forgot to mention, but it's along
these lines. Deeper still here, by the way.
I'm still here. It's along the same lines I didn't get to before. This story was told to me in the media room after the basketball game, so I can't completely verify it. But allegedly, before the game, Dan Werner had a little altercation with Tyler Smith in Tennessee, and he nudged him, whatever that's worth, in pregame. He pushed him a little bit in pregame warmups. And allegedly, after the game, Tyler Smith walks up to Dan Werner and says, "Ain't nobody punks me."
He was right. Dan Werner was not punking.
So that's
not what should be. Why was Dan Werner nudging anyone? Like,
he's the intimidator.
He is the intimidator of this team.
So Dan needs to give him a chest pass off the thigh.
You know, Dan only bounce passes.
I mean, yeah, I don't think you should be pushing Tyler Smith, who, you know, lit you up in the last game. I think that's probably a stupid
dude. Dude's got a teardrop tattoo on his eye.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with goalie. You have a teardrop tattoo.
On the one hand, I do like the lack of, you know, there's no intimidation there.
It's not, yeah. I mean, it's a little personality. It's a little bit of tough.
Yeah, but maybe that's what they need a little bit.
I think basketball is such an emotional sport, and football too, that I think there's no reason to wake a guy up like that previous to the game. Like, maybe Tyler was like, oh, I'm just going to take it easy tonight. But as soon as Dan pushed him, that's it. He's going into, you know, killer mode.
Nudged.
And I remember there was a game when the 04s were here my freshman year against Alabama, where Alabama jumped out to a huge lead, and during a timeout, Steele and Jamario Davidson, was that the guy's name? The tall center?
They come over and
start talking a mess of smack to the UF bench, just like going nuts. And all that did was wake them up, and they came back and won the game, of course. So I feel like smack talk is different than the baseball code of ethics, which is very cut and dry, actually. Like, if you do something bad, you're going to get thrown at. That's just the way things go. And it's one message and it's over with. And you can't really, like, emotion's not going to help you, like, hit a fastball or something like that. So, whereas the physical play of basketball, I think it's stupid to wake guys up like that.
So, why is it okay in baseball but not in other sports?
I think it's okay. I think it's just not smart. I think you're doing yourself a disservice by firing up the other team. I don't know if you guys agree with that.
No, I'm with you. Baseball is not that, like, your passion can't enter into it.
Emotion can't lead you to take over a game like it can in a basketball or some other kind of sport like that.
One more thing before we move on from baseball talk. I'm looking at the attendance figures from this weekend series, and the showing was great by the fans for Friday and Saturday's games. Over 4,500 listed for both of those games, which I'll buy if the stadium holds that much. Whatever capacity is, I'll definitely buy that for Friday's game. But today's game, Sunday's game, attendance is listed at over 3,000 people. Now, me and McCall, we had 20 fingers between the two of us, and that was plenty for the fans that were there at today's game. I don't blame them. It was really cold. They had dropped the first two games. You got two starters who maybe aren't that great going against each other. But I cannot believe how these attendance figures are made. And what's worse is that it put it into the third highest attendance series at McKeithen of all time. So I don't know how they come up with this stuff, but I'm sure we all have stories about SIDs sitting in the press box doing a little hand count of numbers.
Well, first, I think that a lot of this attendance stuff might have to do with tickets sold and not necessarily people in the boxes, because I'm sure they sold 3,000 tickets because they do season tickets in the series. But, I used to cover the Santa Fe men's basketball and baseball beats, and it's a much more relaxed environment at Santa Fe College Athletics. The athletics director sitting in the press box with you, arm around you. So, you know, you're not gonna see Jeremy Foley doing that anytime soon. But, you know, they would be, you know, a couple families at a baseball game, you know, just, you know, sisters and brothers and, you know, maybe 50 people, and they just look at it and go, yeah, that looks like about 75, or yeah, it looks like about 100. So, I mean, the attendance figures are always, you know, kind of shady. You can never trust them.
Or how bad it got today with the blowout win. I think in the fourth inning, when Miami scored 7 runs, went up 7-0. A bunch of Florida fans start filing for the exits. And there's, like, you know, a handful of Miami fans there today. And at that point, they outnumbered Florida fans.
Yeah, definitely.
And the game got so bad that Miami fans started leaving.
Yeah, they were going to jumpstart going back to Coral Gables or whatever. But it was really, by the end of the game, I would say there were, like, 100 people there that stuck around for the whole game. So, anybody out there who wonders when they go to these games, oh, I wonder how they come up with the attendance figures. Like, they sound so official. They're not official at all, as far as I'm concerned.
The fun thing is, though, when they use them as official numbers, like, you know, at a coach's press conference, perhaps, when he'll stand up and, you know, say about how impressive the attendance was and say, like, oh, we had 1,337 fans in the stadium this weekend, and that's great. And it's like, no, you didn't. Somebody just made that number up. And there you go.
Softball's hilarious because they don't even sell tickets for softball. Yeah. So it's pretty much like you're going off of what capacity is, and then you're just trying to, oh, there's standing room only today. What would you say that crowd is, Jim? I don't know, 1,200. Like, and that's what they roll with for the official numbers. So it's really funny that even like university athletics, it's like a little league system of determining attendance.
Speaking of softball, though, there was a huge crowd there Saturday for the first couple of games. They played 6 games this weekend, 6 games in 3 days as part of the Cox Invitational here in Gainesville. Florida won all 6 games in pretty convincing fashion. But the big news out of the weekend is that center fielder Kim Waldazonia in the Texas Tech game Saturday Right after she'd broken the career hits record at UF, it was a great day for her. She was running down first base. She just dropped a bunt, sped into first base, and when she got tagged, she went flying through the air. The tag was unnecessarily harsh. I don't know why she even tagged her. She could have forced her out at first, but then Wallazzoni went flying through the air and landed harshly, and I don't know exactly what the extent of the injury is. We haven't been updated yet, but it looked to be something in her left leg, possibly her knee, so she could be out for quite some time. And that's really going to affect the team going forward.
Are you saying there was ill intent?
I'm not saying there was ill intent. I don't know why the play was made. Maybe because she was closer to it than she was the bag. But I don't understand why the play was made.
That was baseball. I would have thrown at her, by the way. She came up, I would have been all for it.
Do you get thrown at in softball? Does that ever happen?
Kyle, have you ever seen it?
I think we saw it once last season. Georgia Tech in the regional. Oh, yeah. This girl came around. Georgia Tech's only good player. She played a great game, even though they lost. And she scored a run. It might have been their first run of the game. They were losing by a lot. And as she crossed home plate, she pointed into the stands at these people that were heckling her all game. Did a little, like, clap excited thing. Like, yeah, I'm like, I just scored a run. I'm the bomb type thing. And she promptly got hit by a pitch next time she was up. And I never got the answer whether or not she got hit on purpose. But I totally buy they threw at her, which is sweet. They should throw it more.
It's absolutely softball. Sweet.
You support the baseball code of ethics going into softball.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's how you deal with people. There's no need to fight or argue in baseball, or in this case, softball. You just hit them. Next time they come up, they know why they got hit. They take their base for it. You know, that's that.
How about intentionally spiking the ball in someone's face in volleyball? Would you condone that?
I can't see a scenario that would happen.
Well, if you're taunting, why not?
I mean, if you like, happy,
like during
you know,
a dead
like...
ball situation?
No, during the game, like intentionally spiking
that
the girl's face.
Well, that's like the McCall, like just strike him out thing. I mean, if you're allowed to spike the ball, like if the girl can play defense and, I don't know, not get hit in the face, I'd say, yeah, that's fair. If you want to aim for a face, sure, that's cool.
How about letting a defensive lineman throw in football and flipping him over your back like Ronnie Bass?
Obscure reference.
Yeah. Or going the longest yard or what's the prison movie?
Longest show.
Longest show. Yeah. And throwing at him, throwing at the defender when he comes to the line. I'd like to see that next year.
Sure. I'm for all of this. But however you want to exact your revenge on opposing players who have acted up is cool with me as long as you're not trying to injure them.
All right,
but anyway, back to Kim Walls.
So wait, I was going to say, I'm going to reel it back on topic. Actually, Evan's going to bring us back off.
I just want to say, like, you described Walzoni as flying through the air. Like, can you describe, like, how she felt?
She went in the air. Her body was horizontal, and she sort of spun. I think that would be it.
The tag was that harsh?
Yeah.
Can we say John Elway diving for the end zone?
That's actually how
you
describe it.
Sam Bradford-esque?
At the speed she was running and, you know, the way she was tagged and the way, you know, the angle she was taking, yeah. And then she landed in foul territory, I would say. But, yeah, let's get back to that, the injury a little bit. That's going to really affect the team going forward. I don't know how long she's going to be out, but, I mean, it's going to have some effect. Kyle, what do you see him doing here?
I was going to ask you what changes you see them making in the lineup, what you saw this weekend for Sunday's games, how he tried to compensate, who's playing the outfield, stuff like that.
Well, they put Kelsey Bruder at her spot in the lineup, put her in the two hole. I don't know why they're making that decision. I feel like Christina Hilberth would be a little bit more of a natural fit there, and she's having a pretty decent season so far. So, I mean, he's still going to mess with the lineup. We know Tim Walton, he really enjoys messing around with that lineup even during the game. But, in the outfield, he did a couple of different things. I can see freshman Michelle Moultrie. She's going to get a lot of time. She's really fast. She might even see some time in that two spot. So, I mean, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how he changes it, especially because, I mean, next weekend starts SEC play here. So, I mean.
I agree. Bruder's probably not the answer in the two hole. I think she strikes out a little too much. She can't really. I've never seen any evidence that she can handle the bat, meaning she bunts well or hits the ball the other way when she has to do stuff like that. Maybe she can. I don't know. I always think of her as like a feast or famine home run hitter, though, pretty much. And I think putting somebody like Hilbert there, he's hit there before, really good bunter. I think that's probably a better fit for them. But I wanted to ask you, too, because I tried to follow the games as much as I could. You know,
through my live
and
blogs?
Stuff, and through your glorious live blogs. And Brombacher struggled for the first time all season. So I wanted you to talk about that a little bit and what you saw and in her makeup and how she did.
Yeah, after drinking all the Brombacher Kool-Aid that you were last week.
I was told that I was drinking the Brombacher Kool-Aid. I would not say that I'm sipping from that cup anymore. She had a couple of rough outings. I mean, Saturday especially, I mean, she gave up a couple of quick runs. I think those were maybe her first runs, earned runs all season. So, I mean, it's not like the sky is falling here. You know, oh no, Stephanie Brombacher gave up a couple of runs. She's still undefeated, you know. I mean, she's still pitching well. The thing that concerned me more about that, though, is that Walton had a little less confidence in her. He just yanked her from the game, whereas he said I don't know, last week or maybe, I think last weekend, you know, he had the confidence in Brombacher to leave her in those games, and that's the difference between last year. But then, you know, Stephanie loads the bases and Stacey's coming into reliever. So, I mean, I don't know how that's going to go forward, you know, into the SEC season. Maybe Stacey sees a lot more innings than Stephanie has been seeing so far. But
yeah, I want to say a couple things on that. Even her freshman year last year, she started the season on some unbelievable streak of not like 20 innings to start her UF career without giving up a run, and it was very impressive. But I think what you saw is what I saw a lot last season, is that she's susceptible to the big inning, which is Stacey Nelson. Her mental makeup is so incredible that when she loads the bases and she gets in trouble, she knows when she has to go after a hitter and absolutely needs an out. I feel like Stephanie doesn't really have that extra gear, and when things start coming undone, they're going to come undone. She has nothing to really stop it, and I think that's the difference, the main difference between the two of them right now, is maybe the mental makeup and how Stephanie handles things when she gets into trouble, even as rare as that may be.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the beginning. She gave up 5 runs to Pacific on Friday. Yeah. I mean,
go look through and check the last time Stacey Nelson's given up 5 runs in a game, the last time, and in an inning's even more ridiculous. She's probably never done it in her whole career. So I think we all got a little out of control with the Stephanie Brombacher hype, but
and by all you mean me?
No. I think at one point I was questioning it too. Like, is she as good as Walton's making her out to be? Can she challenge Nelson? But I think we've kind of seen that she's still going to get bailed out when she needs to be, and that's why she keeps her undefeated record and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I might still make the argument that she's as good as Walton made her out to be. She's nowhere near Stacey's level. I mean, I will no longer even think of making that argument, but I mean, she's still undefeated. She's still got the wins. And I mean, like you said, Stacey is still coming into reliever, but she's a trustworthy number two.
But this weekend was a perfect example. What I always talk about why she's undefeated and why she never gets losses. They play Pacific. She gives up 5 runs, which Stacey could never get away with. But her team scores 10 runs because it's Pacific, and she's facing some second-rate pitcher. So she doesn't get the loss for that. And then you said she loaded the bases, what, in her next outing, and Stacey came in and relieved her?
Yeah, that was Saturday.
Right. So then that's theory number two, which is Stacey's always got her back, whereas when Stacey's starting, it's not like Stephanie comes in and slams the door for her against, you know, tough competition. So I think you got a good illustration of why she hasn't lost yet in her career. It's not necessarily that she's a great pitcher. I mean, she is a good pitcher, but it's because of circumstances a lot of times.
Yeah, and I'll absolutely agree to that. But, I mean, you will admit that she has improved from last year, right?
Yeah, I think she's been great so far this season. But she was good at the end of last season, too. I think she kind of wore down for a little bit last season, like towards the middle, maybe the beginning of the end of the season. And then she kind of refocused and she pitched well again. She had a couple good outings in the World Series when she was used, even though it was few and far between. And I think that she got off to a great start this season, but we've kind of seen it before from her. So we'll see how she does against SEC opponents and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that starts Friday, this coming weekend against South Carolina. I think they're on the road. So that should be interesting to see how Brombacher and how the team reacts without Wallazonia. But we should be learning a little bit more about Kim's injury Tuesday, so keep an eye on our website for that. And I think that about wraps it up for the show. So thanks for listening once again. Send any feedback to sports@alligator.org or comment on one of our blogs. Evan, go ahead, talk about the Red Wings real quick.
Yeah, all you Red Wings haters this week, you're going to be loving this. They lost 8-0 to the Nashville Predators on Saturday night. It was terrible, but don't panic yet.
Evan is crying right now about the loss.
He's
Evan
so desperate to talk about hockey that he'll even talk about a loss.
Even when his team loses.
8-0, that was embarrassing.
I want to say something about the response email that we're looking for. I'm committing that we will read it on the podcast. Anything that is sent in, if it's appropriate, and you guys know what that means, just send it in and we'll read it on air, because I want to do something to try to get people involved, maybe get some feedback,
Stuff
you'd like to hear. So we will read it for sure in this podcast with over 200 downloads total.
250.
Oh, wow. It's just blown up. It's all over at this point.
All right, check back for another podcast later this week, and thanks for listening.